I'm Bill Castle, and this is Free Expression. This program is all about conveying the Christian message from a Catholic point of view and defending the liberty which makes it possible to do that. We talk with creative, interesting people about authentic civics education, censorship-free online searches, and thinking clearly in a chaotic time. Join us. Sit back and enjoy some free expression. I'm hardly the only person who shakes his head at certain views people hold these days. So many things we once considered simple facts of reality, you know, like that individuals are responsible for their actions or that women are the ones who can get pregnant, well, a lot of folks today insist they're just wrong. Maybe it's my age, but I find it increasingly difficult to think clearly. I could use a philosophical tune-up. And John Mark Miravalle has written a book that might be helpful in that regard. It's called Thinking Clearly, Catholic Philosophy for a Culture in Chaos. Dr. Miravalle teaches theology at Mount St. Mary's Seminary in Maryland, and he's here right now. Professor, thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
I grew up in a time when right and wrong were thought of as pretty straightforward. Maybe we were a little overconfident about that. Maybe we didn't always see the shades of gray in between. But at least there were principles to guide us. What happened to our moral expectations?
Probably a lot of things, but really, on the Catholic understanding, morality is deeply tied to purpose. If human beings weren't made on purpose by someone for some goal, then it's hard to see how we can have any kind of objective purpose. So when you get rid of God as the ground of morality, I don't think really it's possible to consistently maintain an objective standard of right and wrong for people.
So in a sense, faith comes first.
If not faith, yes, in practice faith, but at least belief in the existence of a creator, which of course is not technically something that requires faith, but often is. We can know from reason that the world is created by an intelligent and good being. And that's at least the minimum you need to make sense of why people should do certain things, because you can only talk that way reasonably if they were made by someone who wanted them to do certain things and be a certain way.
What does Catholicism as such offer in this way? I mean, certainly there's a long history of scholarship, a long history of wise men thinking deep thoughts, but is it really a philosophical basis for living your life?
The relationship between Catholicism and philosophy is a very interesting one and very long. And I'll just mention a couple features. Theology or the Church's doctrine and our reflection on the Church's doctrine, that tells us about the ultimate truth based on God's revelation. Philosophy can tell us about not all the ultimate truths, but some of the ultimate truths, simply based on what is accessible through universal human experience. So what's great about the relationship between the Catholic Church and philosophy is that philosophy and then theology keep each other grounded. For instance, if you're trying to make sense of the world as a philosopher, and you come up with something that contradicts the faith, well, you know you have to go back and recheck your homework. So someone once said the church allows philosophy to have the answers in the back of the book. So you can go back and make sure you're getting it right. But also, philosophy is the way we make sense of our faith, and we see that what Catholicism says actually corresponds to our universal experience as human beings. So it's a very mutually supportive thing, which is why the Catholic Church is really the greatest preserver of philosophy and philosophical progress in human history.
And yet there are many people who would dismiss the idea of religious faith and do that on the basis of what they would consider philosophy.
Right, and that's actually a philosophical mistake, because people will often say, and I've debated people like this in public. I actually got my job because I started out doing atheist debates, which are on YouTube. and the rector of the seminary saw them and offered me the job at the Mount. But in any case, they'll often say, well, listen, faith and reason are opposed. The funny thing is, if you ask them for a definition of faith or reason, often they can't give it. Because if reason just means deductions and inference, then actually there's lots and lots of things we don't know through the deduction and inference. You know what you had for breakfast today, not by deduction and inference. And you know that in 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue, not through deduction and inference. We also have personal experience, and we have belief in the testimony of reliable witnesses. And that's just a natural, normal part of human experience. So if someone's trying to say philosophy is the only basis, they're actually undercutting a philosophical truth on how many different ways we acquire knowledge. And faith is simply one of those.
Philosophy can seem sort of intimidating or highfalutin or somehow beyond the ordinary person. How do you encourage somebody to get past that and give this a serious look?
Yeah, that's a great question. So actually, philosophy is the least specialized, least highfalutin, least elitist of any human discipline. Because philosophy just means reflecting on what everybody can know by their own experience. So philosophy is the most common pursuit that there is. And that's what makes it so useful for evangelization, because to do evangelization, you have to meet people where they're at, and that means finding common ground. And philosophy deals with the ultimate common ground of what every normally functioning adult already knows. And that's why I would say, actually, that if somebody thinks they're doing philosophy, but they can't explain what they're doing to an average guy on the street, they're actually not doing philosophy anymore at all. They may be doing something else like history of intellectual development or something like that. But philosophy is absolutely democratic.
Yeah, I guess in a sense we all have a philosophy, even if we don't necessarily think that we do.
Absolutely, because we all have common universal human experiences, and we all reflect on those. So philosophy just encourages people to continue reflecting on those and to dialogue about them and to try to think about them as clearly as we can. And when we do that, turns out, it always leads to God.
Well, aside from reading your book, which I guess is a given in terms of the advice you would give to people thinking about philosophy, what are some other authors that would be accessible and wouldn't necessarily scare people off?
The guy who's really done great work in the Catholic world on this is Peter Craik, right? He's really brought philosophy to the common Catholic, and, you know, he's written scores of books. C.S. Lewis, actually, is one of the great philosophers, I think, who really tried to make it accessible, as I say philosophy should be. Plato, I mean, ironically enough, a lot of people are intimidated by Plato, but it might be because they've never read him, is very readable, very accessible. Augustine, I mean, the names go on and on. Someone pointed out that, I think it was Lewis, he said, great minds are often great because they're easy to read. What makes them intimidating is when you read the people talking about them.
Yeah, that's a very good point.
There's an awful lot of great philosophy that's really available to people, and they shouldn't be intimidated. And John Paul II said, it's actually become necessary for evangelization.
And necessary for our continuance as a civilization. We seem to have entered a period of very shallow thinking, a lot of confused ideas. I assume that your advice and the principle underlying your book is that people simply have to start thinking again.
I think that's right. They have to start thinking, and only by thinking well are you able to reach another person. So one of the goals of this book is it puts, at the end of each section, practice conversation scenarios that you and another person can do as exercises. Well, you imagine someone, for instance, who's just lost her husband, and she wants to know, is there any philosophical reason to think he's still alive, that his soul has survived? And you go back and forth. Because I think our well-being and the well-being of those around us depends on getting our concepts in order.
The book is Thinking Clearly, Catholic Philosophy for a Culture in Chaos. It's from Our Sunday Visitor Press, and it's coming out right about now. I assume it's available at this point. Is it in general circulation?
It is, yes. You can go to the Our Sunday Visitor website. It's on Amazon, and presumably Catholic bookstores.
John Mark Miravalle, Thinking Clearly, Catholic Philosophy for a Culture in Chaos. Thanks very much for taking time to tell us about this. It sounds like a fascinating read.
Thank you so much.
We tend to think of online search engines, Google, Yahoo, DuckDuckGo, and others, as simple tools for finding information. We type in what we're looking for, and they go about sifting data and then present us with whatever's out there on the topic we're searching. Unquestioning, completely neutral, well, that's not exactly how it is. Algorithms, those mysterious combinations of numbers we hear so much about, choose the sites we're directed to, and those choices can reflect the business or political interests of the people behind the search engines we use. There's a new engine in the search market now, one that takes a different approach. It's called Freespoke, and Kristen Jackson, one of its developers, insists that it's the key to uncensored searching. She's with us now. Kristen, thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
How do search engines work?
Search engines really go out and they create a crawler that's going to crawl all of the information that's stored across the World Wide Web. And then what they try to do is decipher your search query and organize all of the content that it has crawled into recency and relevancy results to answer your question.
As regards the concern about censorship, how does the search engine know which questions to accept and which questions to block or de-emphasize?
I think how we kicked off this conversation is important because, as I stated, and as I think a lot of probably your listeners and many of us do, is we ask Google a question and we trust that it's giving us an answer. But what we have come across is that there's skepticism now that we can really trust that answer. The engine is doing the best it can to decipher your query and understand all the information that exists to answer your question. But when somebody is starting to put their foot on the scale and say, we want to make sure that this type of COVID information is accessible, but not this kind, or we want to make sure the Hunter Biden laptop information becomes accessible at some point, but maybe just not yet. Or, you know, we want to make sure that climate change information is derived from the United Nations research on it and maybe not other results. So generally speaking, there's not a foot on the scale, and it's just a technological approach to gathering information and ranking recency and relevancy, but we do see some foots on the scale coming into play.
How is Freespoke different than in your approach?
So we are also utilizing recency and relevancy, because generally when you're searching for something, that's what you're looking for. And we've added elements into that search result. So we label content, we label it left, middle, right. We have a handful of other labels we can get into that I think your audience would be interested in. But what we do is we make sure that when you get a recent and relevant result, you are receiving multiple perspectives.
Oh.
And it guarantees that one perspective doesn't get buried.
I notice on your welcome page there that you do suggest certain stories. How do you make those judgments?
Those are just hot topics of the day, and we do that because, you know, we're so trained to use Google, and when you're introducing a new search engine, we want to help people get that experience right away, right? So you kind of look at a blank box and you think, well, what do I do? You know, like, you're so used to pulling up your general search engine and just asking everything. So we prompt you with a couple searches that you can start out with, and they do highlight how we are showing the full perspective that you may not get in other search engines.
I've often wondered, and I'm sure a lot of other people do too. I mean, I may download a search engine and it doesn't cost me anything. Where's the money? How do you guys get paid for this very valuable service that you're providing?
The status quo for search engines is really to monetize you, the user, by leveraging your data. Google makes only about $60 a year from you utilizing Google in all of the areas in which you utilize it. It gathers all of that information about you, and it sells that data to advertisers so they can feed you an ad that's very specified to your interests. And you click on that, and everybody makes money. that's one of the areas where we are upending that status quo, and we're saying privacy really just should be a baseline expectation going into the future. So we are not leveraging your data in that way. In FreeSpoke, you come in, you search, your searches are anonymous. We are not tracking you or what you are searching. We are providing some advertising. If you search for pillows or tractors, you may see a pillow or tractor related advertisement because we think that can help you. And we are not a nonprofit, so we are looking to produce revenue. And then we have an alternative path where you can pay for premium. And I think as people start to prioritize this changing the status quo, people will be willing to pay a limited amount. If it's only $60 a year that Google is garnering from you, maybe you would pay FreeSpoke $30 a year to protect your privacy, make sure you're getting all of the news and information and all the perspectives.
All right, so if I sign up for FreeSpoke now, there won't be a charge at this point. That's coming down the road later?
That's correct. You can sign up for premium today, though. So you can go to FreeSpoke.com, try it out, be wowed, hopefully, and then you have the option there to the first call to action is to download FreeSpoke. You can make it your default search engine in your computer or on your phone through your app store. And then the second opportunity will be to sign up for premium. So you can check that out there today.
It does seem like that people are really becoming aware of online censorship. It's been so spoken of and so written about that it really is a hot topic. I imagine that you have perceived that as an opportunity, a market to be served.
We're feeling it, and we are those people as well, right? So we came at this from one of you, one of us, who are saying our First Amendment right is extremely important to protect. And what is happening to it? What is happening to that free debate of ideas that really founded our country and made us so strong? It's well documented that COVID was an era when people were trying to understand the information that existed, and they were trying to make smart decisions for their family in a very scary and trying time. And they did not feel like their search engines were serving them. You are absolutely correct that skepticism has really taken off since that COVID era.
Well, if people want to try it out or even download it, what's that URL again where they can find you?
You can just check out freespoke.com on your computer. Go to freespoke, FreeSpoke, freespoke.com, or you can go to your app store and check it out on your phone. And I would, just before we wrap, I'd like to highlight something else that I think may be of interest to your audience. We decided from day one that we weren't going to show pornography in FreeSpoke. It was really a decision by my co-founder who just kind of questioned that norm. And he said, this is an information search engine. Why would we even show that? And so we didn't from day one. We haven't showed pornography. But what we have learned over the last few years is that pornography is the third most common form of sex trafficking. Many of these women are not choosing to do this. Many are children. You know, once you start digging into this, you realize how people are abducted and utilized in this way, and money is made through being able to put this online. So if you want to support a search engine that's changing that status quo and saying, hey, this is an information search engine, you can find anything you're looking for, but what people term adult entertainment doesn't need to be in this information search engine that we hand our 8, 9, 10-year-olds.
Kristen Jackson, freespoke.com, a search engine that is trying to get around this censorship issue, and I wish you good luck with this. I hope it really takes off.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
It's often said that the problems we face in this country could be, if not solved, at least lessened if people had a better understanding of how our political system works. What we need is to bring back civics education, they'll say. Well, I remember taking civics in school, and it was indeed helpful to learn about the Constitution and the three branches of government and all the rest. The trouble is that things have changed so much since I was a kid. Education has been swept up in ideology, mostly of the leftist variety. How can we be sure that what's being taught in civics would be at all fair or accurate? Craig Ryan is president of the Freedom Education Foundation, and he has a program for teaching civics that seeks to address that very concern. Craig, thanks so much for being with us.
Good to be with you, Bill. It's been a terrible thing to watch as our schools have adopted the leftist ideology, and it's just been very exciting to develop a curriculum countering all this move. We've developed a 20-session course that covers the founding from the first time that our forebears came from England to establish the colonies and their freedom of religion and freedom of speech that they had for 100 years before the Constitution. Also to go back and trace what the founders knew about the ancient roots of our freedoms. It's just been very exciting to develop it, and now we're in the process of getting the word out. We're working on our third edition now, and it's very succinct, Bill. It's not that we're going to totally replace all history education, but many teachers like to take different lessons and plug them into their existing curriculum. We set out initially to go to the public schools, and we thought we'd have a chance with the more conservative states. But the teachers' unions have gotten so strong, and what they did going back about 50 years ago is they stopped, like you said, they stopped offering standalone civics class. And they said, oh, we don't need that. We'll just plug in various things into language arts and social studies, and the kids will learn that way. Well, they haven't. The statistics are awful. I think it's like 65% of students in Tennessee and Arizona couldn't identify the first president of the United States.
Looking through your teacher's manual, I see that there are all kinds of things in there that I doubt ever come up in schools these days. You go pretty deeply into the Articles of Confederation and the Northwest Ordinance. Does anybody address these things nowadays?
Bill, it is such an important part of our founding. Most people talk about the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. Well, the whole development of property rights that was done in the Northwest Ordinance and treating the Indians with respect and paying them properly for lands taken, also setting the stage to the elimination of slavery. The Northwest Ordinance was explicit that there would be no slavery in the Northwest Territories, which is what they were called those days. Our founders knew that slavery was embedded and it was culturally acceptable worldwide, but they knew that one day it had to go. And so what they did is they, in order to get the southern colonies to go along with coming together to be unified against Britain in the Revolutionary War, they knew that they couldn't address slavery in the Constitution. So what they did, and it passed 17-0 to outlaw slavery in the Northwest Territories.
Yeah, nowadays everything is viewed through the lens of slavery and the exploitation of the downtrodden native peoples and whatever. Everything that can conceivably be a negative in our history is magnified way out of proportion.
They focus on all of that, and instead of talking about how for the first time in history, people self-regulated and had, you know, for the people, by the people, and electing our own presidents and not being dictated by a monarch. Instead of focusing on that, they'll focus on the sins of our forefathers. And as you and I know, we've all sinned, and we're all sinners, and we screw up. Forefathers knew that. And so that's why they devised a system with three branches of government where they can balance each other out and check on one another.
You mentioned that you've encountered resistance in the public school market. Who is adopting this curriculum?
We realize that the homeschool movement has grown by leaps and bounds, as have the Catholic schools and other private Christian schools. And that's where we're going. We're trying to reach the kids in that. It's sad, but we just don't have the money, the resources to go after public education at this point. I think eventually in states like Idaho and Texas and Florida, there will be more interest in taking our work and putting it in the public schools. But for right now, we're targeting homeschools. And that's hard to do because the age of the children changes quickly and then they go on to college. And so it's hard to send it other than these homeschool associations.
I can imagine, though, that young parents who came up through public schools and never became acquainted with most of this material themselves, they might feel a little intimidated in trying to teach civics to their children. Yet you seem to make it easy for them. Your book is laid out in a very methodical way. It's very clear. How did you conceive of this to help parents?
Our idea was that even though it's not fancy, glitzy videos, which so much of teaching is done now that way, that it's readable material. And it's actually quite beautifully written, if I don't say so myself. We involved teachers and historians, and then we had sent it out for review to various public schools and private schools and homeschoolers and got their feedback. And we wanted it very readable so that a parent could assign the reading. The reading level is fairly high. It's intended for high school students, not young junior hires. If it were an advanced junior high class, it would work. But the idea is to have the reading material for the student, and then a section of with all sorts of discussion questions, and then quizzes that can be corrected and gone over. And then there's also a final exam provided. It's well put together. I'm hoping that people will go to our website and order it. It's freedomcivics.org is our website.
Freedomcivics.org.
There was a call to have a college edition. So we have just put to bed the college edition, and we're just about to send it to the printer. One of our board members is Dr. Clark Summers, and he's from Belmont Abbey College in North Carolina, which is a Catholic college. Clark is quite excited and has used Freedom Civics in his college classes, but there's distinctive differences between the high school version and the college edition.
Sure. FreedomCivics.org. Craig Ryan, hey, thanks for taking time to talk about this. This certainly seems like something that is timely and needed. I wish you the best of luck in getting the word out about this.
Well, thank you, Bill. A pleasure to talk to you, and let's do this again.
Be with us next time when we explore other aspects of religious communication and look deeper into the great Christian heritage of free expression. Free Expression with Bill Castle is a production of Good Shepherd Catholic Radio and Company Publications, where good books, good music, and good radio are always good company. Dan Kuras provided technical assistance. Theme and incidental music are by Dan Adam. The program was produced and directed by Bill Castle. This is Good Shepherd Catholic Radio.